flavour.
This is Cambridge Radio.
I'm going to read you the menu. It's fantastic.
So we get better flavour because of the fen soil.
I've drunk more beer since I came here and bought my two barrels than I've ever done in my life before, I think.
I shouldn't have said almonds. They don't make it from almonds.
So you've got this big sticky mess when you start off.
Pizza pot pies.
My wife's cakes are selling up hotcakes. Brilliant, thank you.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Condicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. And among our local food and drink news and stories today, we find out from Michelin-starred Mark Poynton about his new venture, and Bea Wilson talks to us about her new book. I'm Matt Bentman, and here's Alan Order with more details.
Yes, good afternoon. I've been to Fen Ditton, where opening up is Ancient Shepherds by Mark Poynton. The soft opening is happening now, and Mark and I talked about the food and the drink, and there's an extremely interesting wine in their list.
Flavour guest reporter Jazz Chadder has been to Culinaris in Mill Road, where Bea Wilson was talking about her new book, and Sue Bailey has been chatting with food writer, broadcaster and farmer's wife Jenny Jeffries about her new book, which has just won an international award. And I popped into Great Britannia to find out about how extremes in the weather can affect future wine vintages.
We have our regular features too, free food in Cambridge, local food and drink news, social media updates, and at the end of the programme, our jobs roundup. And just to remind you, we're on social media. We use Instagram at FlavourCam.
Okay, so we begin with a quick trip to 54 Chesterton Road and a new venue called The Artist. Now, this is an art space with a cafe and bar celebrating Syd Barrett's legacy, Syd being one of the founders of Pink Floyd. We first visited The Artist back in February when development was gearing up on what was once the old HSBC site. This week, I met up with owner Matthew Taylor to see how things are shaping up.
One of the favourite things in the venue is this sliding window.
Lean out of the window.
What it means is that we can lean out onto the street and sell our ice creams and coffee. So, yeah, I really like this. I only have to stand here for about a minute and somebody will come and talk to me. So I think it's going to work.
Yeah.
Should be fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fascinating story. Yeah. I think that's why people still remember him and want to celebrate him.
Syd Barrett left Pink Floyd in 1968, but there was no ill feeling. The band helped him with solo projects, but now they began to live very different lives. Syd became a recluse, hidden away for literally decades in his mum's house in Cambridge, where he died.
Yeah, it's that combination. It's the creative genius who suffers for his art, I suppose.
This new venue has the official approval of Syd Barrett's estate and will feature exhibitions, live music, workshops, talks, and of course, food. Some might say it's taken Cambridge a long time to recognise the impact that Syd has had on popular culture, especially in light of Birmingham's efforts rabidly celebrating Aussie and Black Sabbath's contributions. I think there's been a fair few eyes patiently waiting for the opening of The Artist. The Artist, spelt with a Y.
Well, there's been a few delays. I won't go into all the reasons why. But, yeah, we're back on track and we hope to be open within 2 to 4 weeks.
Oh, grand.
Yeah, yeah.
The last time I was here, the only thing I could see was the Madcap Laughs floor.
So you can see a stripy floor.
Red and black stripes.
Which looks like the Syd Barrett album cover, the Madcap Laughs. Well, yeah, other things have happened since then. So if a local artist who's put that Syd Barrett mural together, made up of old newspaper articles, and she's done a kind of psychedelic design for the for one of the walls, which is really nice. Yeah, we've got lots of offers of Syd Barrett-related memorabilia. We've got a Swedish filmmaker who wants to show his films here, all Syd Barrett-related. He does the films for a band called Sourceful of Secrets, which is Nick Mason's band. We're still touring. And I think they're doing a lot of the earlier Pink Floyd stuff.
Yeah.
And we're going to be showing them here. Put it on a loop, he's made a lot of them.
And seeing as we are a food programme.
Yes. Well, the beer should be on supply next week. Coffee machine should be installed next week. Mm. We're going to start with vegetarian hot dogs. Again, there's a Swedish connection there. My son, he imports them from Sweden.
Yeah. That's a slightly unusual thing for a son to do.
It is, not for me. He's been doing them. He does the May balls. Yeah, his business is vegan fast food.
Yeah.
Whatever he's got left is what we'll be selling.
The windows have all gone in now,
yeah,
which was different to the last time I was here. Everything's looking very bright and airy.
Good.
It's looking like it's going to be a very attractive place to come along.
Well, I sincerely hope so, yeah. Everyone says it's well positioned because we're at the traffic lights on Chesterton Road.
There really is, because this is a Saturday afternoon and all of the other eateries along, they're all full.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. This whole area seems to have been transformed over the last year or so, I think. So a lot of places that had been empty for years, like Belfast Bed Centre on the corner, huge, great building, that's now going to be a restaurant. Boots Chemist, that's now a restaurant. Yeah, I think about five or six just on this short stretch that have opened up recently. Good food, good drink. There are quite a few delis around here as well, Hungarian, Italian,
yes,
Polish. Yeah, so I think it'll become the, could be the food and drink quarter of Cambridge. Who knows?
So yes, we can fully expect the Artist Cafe and Bar to be opening its doors within the next few weeks. Like Matthew was saying, it joins several other venues that have opened up relatively recently on that stretch of Chesterton Road, including that Hungarian deli, Taste from Hungary, which we covered early last year, along with the Italian deli, La Dispensa, and other new places like the Coffee Inn, the new restaurant that's taken over the Belfast bed site, where I nearly bought a bed there once, but I didn't, and Great Britannia, who we'll be hearing from later in the programme.
I'm free. I'm free.
And now details of free food available in and around Cambridge, and the information about what's available and where to get it comes from the Olio app. And that exists so that people's or businesses' surplus food doesn't go to waste.
Yes, and it's a bread-heavy day on Olio because Alan, who lives in the new buildings by the train tracks off of Hooper Street, has collected a ton, not literally a ton, of bread and bakery items from Sainsbury's. That includes baguettes, loaves, sliced and whole, bloomers, batons, rolls, plain and seeded. Only the seeded ones will be playing at Wimbledon. Alan only has one rule when it comes to collecting his bread. He simply says, after 11. Next up is a person called Bake, who is based off Woodhead Drive on Milton Road. And Bake has an unopened pack of sugar ring donuts. I counted to make sure they were all there. And finally, Jenna in Chesterton near the Haymakers pub is offering 3 months' worth of stuff that she's collected from hotels. Coffee, tea and decaf coffee pouches. Even what looks like some ketchup sachets. All in one bundle, she says. So if your supplies of individual sachets for the glove compartments are running low, Olio is the place to go.
It certainly is, isn't it? But there is, of course, another app which is called Too Good To Go. And that has unsold food from restaurants, cafes and shops, often at less than half price. And they don't know what's going to be unsold at the end of the day, so they don't specify what you're going to get. It's simply put into a magic bag ready for you to take home. And that's to prevent it having to go in the bin at the end of the day. And some of the companies that have used it include Greggs in Cherry Hinton, Novi and Namaste, Pret, Upper Crust and Marks and Spencer at the station, Spar in Chesterton, and in Sawston, the Co-op in Sawston, Marks and Spencer at Addenbrookes Hospital, all sorts of places. A good app to have.
Well, with the planned opening of The Artist, Cambridge's food and drink momentum is definitely on the rise.
Yes, it is. It's non-stop, isn't it, really? There's good news from Fen Ditton, where Mark Poynton, who, of course, was a chef at Midsummer House, chef patron of Alimentum, and now at Caister Hall Hotel near Norwich, all three of which have Michelin stars, so he's a very highly regarded and respected chef. He's back in Fen Ditton, where he was running MJP at the Shepherd's, and it's now reopening as Ancient Shepherds by Mark Poynton. And I went to talk to Mark about the food, the drinks, that sort of thing. I'm at the Ancient Shepherds by Mark Poynton in Fen Ditton, and I'm with Mark Poynton. And it's a new business for Mark, and a soft opening today, Mark.
Yes, hello. We launch tonight at 6 o'clock, first customers coming in. New business. It's almost like Ancient MJP at the Shepherds Mark II, as we were here 5 years before. We've had a refurb and a rebrand, go back to the old original name of the Ancient Shepherds by Mark Poynton, offering tasting menus only, lunch and dinner.
So what sort of things are in the tasting menus then?
So at lunch we offer a free course tasting menu for £35 and 5 courses for £55, and dinner 5 courses £55 and 7 courses £85. And on that you'll find things like a beautiful garden beetroot and goat's cheese tart with pickled beetroot and walnuts from the garden, a beautiful slow roasted breast of duck which is cooked on the bone with beautiful carrots spiced slightly with star anise, and parfait made from livers and sauce made from all the bones. And then dessert wise we got a lovely beautiful duo chocolate, it's a milk chocolate mousse with a dark chocolate centre, garnished with a little coffee and hazelnut as well.
Right, this sounds fantastic. Isn't a tasting menu a lot more work for the chefs? I wonder why you've chosen tasting menus.
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. So we know everybody's going to have the same thing. Whereas there's a choice of menus, we need to prep. Say we've got 34 people booked tonight. If we have a choice menu, say three starters, three main courses, three desserts, we have to prep enough of everything just in case everybody orders it. Whereas tonight we just need to prep 34 portions.
Yeah.
So from a sustainability level, we're not wasting anything. From a consistency level, everything's exactly the same. And from staff wellbeing level, we know exactly what they're doing without that thought process of, oh my God, I've got 12 of these and 10 of these, I might run out sort of thing. So yeah, it makes more sense from a business point of view. I know customers might complain that there's not a choice, but offering the 3, 5 and 7 course, we do believe there's a choice.
Yeah. But, well, I mean, what about people who don't eat meat, say? What do they do?
So we cater for almost all allergies and dietary requirements. The only thing we can't cater for is non-dairy, because it just doesn't really sit with the style of food we serve.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we can cater. As long as we've got notice, we can cater, obviously, you know.
You just put a different dish on for the vegetarian.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. But talking about sustainability, I know at MJP at the Shepherd's, you used to grow your own veg. Are you still doing that?
Yeah, so we got 15 strawberry plants, 4 raspberry plants, 22 tomatoes on the go, plus walnut trees. We pick all the walnuts and we're making a nocino with Volta Peritivo in Saffron Walden this year as well. So yeah, we're very much about that, and we use what we can when we can in season from our own garden, plus some of the locals drop stuff off as well, so which is really good.
Oh, do they? Well, yeah. People who just grow locally.
Yeah, so Phil, who lives across the road, he grows about 25 kilo of Jerusalem artichokes, which he drops off for us. And then Jo, who lives on Hyditch Road, she grows loads of tomatoes and cucumbers for us as well. And they come in and we use those as well, and they give them a pint of beer and they're really happy. Almost like the old days.
So it's quite a community place then.
Yeah, very much so. And the people who bought the freehold as well. So it's a new owners of the freehold, Gareth and Emma, John. They live in the village down near the Plough in Fenderton. They live down there, and they've invested in me with the business as well going forward.
Yeah, well, that's brilliant. This shows a lot of confidence in you. And congratulations, Mark, for getting your Michelin star at Caister Hall Hotel.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, yeah. Back where we belong.
Well, I think that's what I thought when I saw it. And will you get one here, do you think?
We want to be full and be sustainable as possible, and, you know, we'll see what goes.
Yeah, okay, right. And I know you've got rooms here as well, so who uses the rooms?
So it's all sorts, from parents visiting Cambridge students, to local businesses, to people going to Newmarket races, and family. Yeah, people come to see families, then they come for dinner, and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's a good mixture, and it's good, as we all know, in Cambridge. Cambridge is short of hotel rooms, so yeah. it's a good thing to have, and it's an extra added thing to our bow, so to speak.
So it works well,
yeah,
then.
Very much so.
Yeah,
much.
I hadn't appreciated that people from Newmarket races might stay here, but I suppose you've got a name and you've got a reputation, haven't you? So people see that and think.
Yeah, they see it, and we always try and offer good value as well. So, you know, rather than staying in a city centre hotel in Cambridge or Newmarket for extortionate price, stay here for half the price.
A much more pleasant environment as well.
Have a good dinner afterwards.
Right. And if you got time, Mark, what about wines?
Yes, so we...
Are they a big deal?
Wines are massive. I love wine myself. I've written a wine list with my main wine supplier, Ed, from Hallgarten Wines. We're using some English, and we're introducing more English wines where possible, but also distilleries as well. Like I said before, Volta Aperitivo. So we're making Nocino. We'll use all those vermouths and stuff for Negronis. Cambridge Distillery, we have our own gin made from forage stuff from the meadows, which I did with Will.
They've done your own sort of bespoke gin?
Yeah, and we're using their lovely vodkas as well. They do a nettle vodka and a lemon verbena vodka, and we've got some of Will's lovely wine as well, Fractal Wine, so that's on the menu as well.
Oh yes, I've seen that. That's not cheap, is it?
It's good. Could do.
But hard to come by.
Very hard to come by. They only make 900 bottles and I've managed to secure 24, so.
Right, well, I think that's pretty good going. I don't think they'll last long.
No.
Great, that's lovely. Nice to see you again,
and
Mark.
You. Thank you, Alan.
And good luck with it.
Thank you.
I'd love to try some of that wine. The soft opening at Ancient Shepherds by Mark Poynton is on now, with 50% off food until the 19th of July. You book online, and if you can't see any availability on the dates you want, it will be because it's fully booked. And when I looked yesterday, there wasn't any availability on any of the dates in the soft opening, so I think it's sold out, but maybe it's worth looking just to see if anything changes.
You know, they say what's in a name, but I really like this name change, calling it the Ancient Shepherds instead of MJP at the Shepherds.
Yes.
Just something that always stuck in my throat a little bit about that.
Right, and it is a fantastically old building as well, so, you know, it's well-named.
Yeah. OK, on to our first news break now for 12th of July 2025. Scottsdale Day has opened at the Engineer's House in Riverside, and its menu can be accompanied by drinks from Calverley's Brewery. They're open Wednesday to Friday from 5pm and at weekends from 12 noon. It's primarily an outdoor venue, but there is some space in the house if things should turn inclement.
There's a Cambridge Biodiversity and Regenerative Food Festival coming up in September. It will be on Parker's Peace. It's a free event and there will be a collection of regenerative growers, bakers, makers, street food vendors, community groups and workshops. And it will be on the 27th of September, running from 10:30 till 4. You can follow it on Instagram, Regen Foods UK. And they are inviting exhibitors to attend if they match the focus of the event, which includes regenerative, organic and agroecological food production, organic gardening and heritage seeds and plants, fermented and preserved foods, and also street food vendors are welcome if they have a sustainability focus. There's an application form to fill in on the Regenerative Foods website if you're interested.
On the 19th of July, Pastor Brewery has an open day from 12 till 6, and there will be a Texan-style barbecue from midday until it sells out. But you can guarantee getting a place by ordering through Meated BBQ website.
At Frank's Farm in Eltersley on the 18th of July, there is a cheese tasting with Allsop and Walker. That's on all day in the deli. On the 20th of July, also in the deli at Frank's Farm, Jack from Bee and Bird Honey is there with honey tasting. And on the 25th of July at Frank's Farm, there's a meal with a Lebanese-inspired menu at 7pm, for which you'll need to book in advance. The cost is £45.
North Stow Tap and Social has a Beano on the 25th, 26th and 27th of July, including a cask ale festival and its first annual bake-off.
And there's a wine tasting garden party at the Yard near Ely on the 25th of July. Early bird tickets are £35 and then it's £45. There will be 8 wines, a 3-course buffet and a special guest, Prue Ward, on violin.
Hmm.
That's the news for now. More later.
Cambridge resident B. Wilson, whose books are always well received, has a new one out. It's called The Heart-Shaped Tin and it's subtitled Love, Loss and Kitchen Objects. B has embarked on a nationwide tour to promote the book, and in Cambridge she spoke about it at Culinaris in Mill Road. Very fitting since owner Zoltan Bogarty features in the book. Jazz Cheddar spoke to B for flavour.
In a way, the idea of this book, The Heart-Shaped Tin, has been inside me for a long time, because at the back of my mind has been this thought that all of us in our different ways, anyone who loves to cook and eat, we get sentimental attachments to certain things. But then the whole story of the heart-shaped tin only really came about after the end of my marriage. And then I found that I was re-examining all of the kitchen objects in my life in a different way. A whole strand of the stories were things that I then associated with the end of my marriage, the aftermath, moving on, objects that friends gave me in an incredibly kind way to console me. And then there was a whole other set of stories which were other people's stories, and people were, some of them were people who were living, some of them were historical stories. The people who were living were just a set of very generous people who told me about their treasured objects, things that were gifts, things that were symbols, things that were mementos. And the more people I spoke to, the more it cemented in me this sense that we're all navigating life, and there's going to be loss and love, one hopes, for all of us. And there's something about those objects that we hold on to that help us find our way through that loss that can be very powerful.
How does love and loss manifest in how we eat and share food?
Anyone that has lived in a family knows nothing ever stays the same. Who's sitting at the table changes, and I can picture one of the first moments of big loss at our table a couple of years before my ex-husband left, of our oldest son going off on gap year to China, and we just constantly laying his knife and fork at the table for a few weeks before I finally thought, oh no, he's not here. But I felt as if there was a ghost at the table. We all have these ghosts. Maybe it's a much-loved grandparent who used to be there and isn't anymore. Maybe it's a friend that you've fallen out with. Maybe it's some family member who's emigrated and lives overseas. So there are all of those kinds of loss. It's this kind of cycle of life thing where nothing stays the same, but the objects stay the same. So I think that's part of why we sometimes cling very tightly to these kitchen objects, because they can give us an illusion that we can hold on to the past.
How does ritual play in eating?
I think ritual is huge. It's much bigger than just Christmas or birthdays or Easter or Eid. There are also these family rituals. Another of the things I wrote about in the book that relates to my own family is the chapter called The Melon Baller, which is about the fact that both my sons, both for some reason, got totally fixated on the family melon baller, which is an object that I hardly ever use, because when do you actually need to ball a melon? But they use it for eating melon. And any time I buy a melon, which isn't very often, it's only really in the summer when melons are delicious, they will scramble to the kitchen drawer to be the person that gets the melon baller rather than any other kind of spoon. And it's, I think food rituals are often about these very specific things that don't make much sense necessarily to outsiders. I think lots of us, we have these kind of daily things which are maybe a substitute for religion in some way. I do think kitchen objects can feel quite sacred, if that's not too pompous a word, but in a low-key, everyday kind of way. They anchor us, these rituals. I mean, the rituals of cooking, there are certain pots and pans that feel like friends to me because they've been in my life so long.
What can you tell us about Zoltan and the story of the corkscrew?
Well, so Zoltan is, he's an amazing man. I knew he was an amazing man. If anyone listening hasn't visited Culinaris, it's an extraordinary place. I think of it as a kind of treasure trove of delights. And to start with, I think I almost felt intimidated by it because there was such a range of beautiful things, exquisitely arranged. So I kind of found myself buying more and more things from Zoltan. And so I was realising he was rather an extraordinary person. But it was only then one day I just somehow was saying something about kitchen objects, and he just casually mentioned that he was a corkscrew collector. And one of the chapters of The Heart-Shaped Tin features Zoltan as the star, and I was so grateful for him to opening up and telling me what it was about corkscrews. He was just a wonderful person to interview because he was so insightful about what it is that drives someone to collect things. And it's never, as so often with our relationship with objects, it's not a really rational process necessarily. I mean, if you like wine, it makes sense to be able to open a bottle of wine, but you don't need 100 corkscrews to open a bottle of wine. He's always wondered about the food of the past, but realised he couldn't taste it. You can never go back. You can't go back 100 years. You can look at old cookbooks, you can get an idea, but all of those textures and smells, they're kind of lost to us. But if you hold a 1900 or 1910 Hungarian corkscrew in your hand, you can imagine exactly what it was like to be the waiter circulating around those Belle Epoque, beautiful cafes of Budapest. And he feels that connection with that person.
Thank you, B, for taking a moment to talk to us about your new book, The Heart-Shaped Tin, now available in the UK.
Yeah, many thanks to Jazz Chadder and B Wilson for that interview, and to Zoltan of Culinaris too for hosting the event. B lavished praise on Culinaris in The Observer a while ago. Amongst the things she said was everything from their pasta to their cheeses and charcuterie to their olive oils and mustards are extraordinary. Also, seasonal products like wild garlic, blood oranges, exquisite sections of Japanese food and Mexican food, and the best dried pasta.
Yeah, it's a great place. I've got three corkscrews and one's broken.
Two more than me. Mine does work, though.
Right, okay.
But I haven't used it.
On to more news now. On the 26th of July, Danny of Danny Cooks has an arepa party. It's a workshop in which you'll learn how to make arepas, and it includes a tasting of traditional sauces, a live cooking demo, and a hands-on session with Danny, including making different sauces and fillings. It's at Douce Heights in Eddington, and it runs from 11 till 1. The cost is £45.
The Petersfield in Hooper Street has announced the dates for its forthcoming supper clubs. That's on the 30th of July with a fermentation supper club, the 27th of August with a Mexican supper club, and the 24th of September with a fusion supper club. These evenings start from 5 p.m. and the cost is £35.
On to market news. Tomorrow, the 13th of July, Caxton's Farmers Market from 9:30 till 12:30, and there's a new stallholder starting there tomorrow, Wheatsheaf Brewery from Huntingdon. Also tomorrow, Bury St Edmunds Farmers Market from 10 till 3. Histon's Farmers Market is on the 19th of July from 9:30 till 1:30. And the Grandson's Farmers Market is from 9 until 1 on the 27th of July.
Quay Hall Estates pop-up shop will be open from the 18th of July from 3 till 7 p.m. at Quay Village Hall. They'll be selling steaks and mince from grass-fed cattle with no antibiotics.
Heath Fruit Farm in Bluntisham has cherries and apricots from its orchard on sale in its self-service kiosk Monday to Fridays, 9 to 5.
If you're starting to wonder what to do with your kids over the summer holidays, the Food Museum in Stowmarket has a forest school running which is suitable for unaccompanied children aged 6 to 11. There's also a school pudding workshop, a family pizza baking morning, and two sessions a week from the end of July to the end of August called Thrills and Grills, using the wood-fired oven, the open fire pit, and the outdoor kitchen to prepare food from scratch.
And there, in Congratulations Corner today, is the Food Museum in Stowmarket, because it's just been awarded a £3.9 million grant from the National Lottery Heritage Fund and a £1 million grant from Mid Suffolk, and that's to enable a major transformation and conservation project. Also in Congratulations Corner is Gutter and Stars, Cambridge's winery, for getting such a good review in the World of Fine Wine magazine. So many congratulations to them both.
And that's our news for now. We'll have news of wine tastings in the second half of the programme, and we'll also find out about how hot the summer is likely to affect English and Welsh wines.
And we'll hear from local food writer Jenny Jeffries about her new book, and that's after the break in about 2 minutes' time, so don't go away.
Cambridge Radio. Weekends on Cambridge Radio. Flavour explores the food scene in Cambridge and South Cams, speaking to the chefs who've made the city their home, the food trucks, the market stall holders, and those delivering fresh food to your door.
It's incredibly important that the bees come first before your needs for a honey crop.
She created a biscuit which I renamed Biscotti di Tutti, because it is a home for all the little bits of dried fruit that are left.
How many bottles do you think we're in here? Oh, 500 is my best guess.
Flavour, on air Saturday at midday and anytime at cambridge.radio.
You know that feeling when your teeth are so clean your tongue can't stop checking? At Wello, we make it easy to keep your smile feeling amazing. No dentist referral needed. And right now, you can enjoy 30% off all cleans, making our welcome appointment just £62 for a pain-free but thorough clean. Get that Wello feeling at Station Place in Cambridge.
Say hello to Wello.
Book now at wellohello.co.uk.
Catch up with your favourite shows online.
Go to cambridge.radio and look for On Demand. We are Cambridge.
Cambridge Radio.
Welcome back to Flavour. Now, South Cambridgeshire food writer, broadcaster and farmer's wife Jenny Jeffries' new book is out. It celebrates the food of the seas and those who bring it ashore. Sue Bailey spoke to Jenny about it.
My most recent book is Islands in a Common Sea, stories of farming, fishing and food around the world. And this really celebrates regenerative agriculture and regenerative aquaculture all over the world. So I invited 25 farmers and fishermen from all continents to contribute a recipe showcasing what they catch and what they produce, as along with stories written from the heart by themselves about what they do, how they do it and why. And yes, it's just recently won an award. It won Best Fundraising in Europe for in the World Gourmand Cookbook Awards. So £2 from every copy sold of Islands in a Common Sea is being donated to the United Nations World Food Programme to their award-winning Share the Meal campaign.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. And what a lovely initiative to get involved in something like that. So what was it like going to the awards? Where were they?
They were in Lisbon, in Portugal, in Cascais, and it was just beautiful. I literally flew in just for one night. So it was just a wonderful experience just to represent all the people who are featured and contributed to the book. It's not just myself. It's a fantastic collaboration between farmers and fishermen from all continents. So to walk on the stage when they called out the name of Islands in a Common Sea was just amazing. It was a real privilege to be there, to accept it in person, and we had the opportunity to say a few words as well, which was really special. So I just took the opportunity to thank all the farmers and the fishermen, not just who contributed to the book, but also those all over the world, because without them there is simply no food.
So how did you choose which ones to come up with? That must have been quite a difficult choice.
Definitely, because the more you read about all these fantastic food producers doing really extraordinary, innovative, community-spirited food production, it's just incredible. And there are so many people doing extraordinary things around the world. I started researching it probably about 3 or 4 years ago whilst I was researching my other books. And I knew I wanted to do a book featuring farmers and fishermen outside of the UK. And so I just started researching, doing a lot of reading. For example, I was reading The Middle Eastern Eye, as you do, and I came across this fantastic photojournalist who covered a story of a beekeeper in Yemen, and the photos were just amazing, and I knew that it would be a sort of coffee table, but a very adaptable and practical story cookbook. And so a lot of social media, a lot of research, a lot of reading, and also doors opened, one door opened another door, and you just got to meet lots of wonderful people. I did it all from sitting at my kitchen table. For example, my parents were on holiday at the Hofmaran Hotel in Switzerland one summer, and they got talking to the manager of the hotel, and they realised that their dairy producer was in Switzerland, and I knew that would be a wonderful story because the photos would just be beautiful of these sort of mountains and wonderful hay baling in on the side of a mountain in Switzerland and dairy cows. So a lot of thought and consideration came into with reference to not just the geographical location but the story and also the produce that they produce as well. So I wanted a real variation of geographical countries and also the different variation of produce as well.
So do you feel that you've covered all the areas that you want to cover, or are there more books to follow on this theme?
I'd love to say that there are more books, but not at this stage. I think I covered what I wanted to cover. All the main food groups were covered. Meat, fish, dairy, vegetables, herbs, honey. So I feel like I've sort of done what I wanted to set out to do with Islands in a Common Sea. So, but watch this space.
You mentioned about the photography. Is that done by the individuals, or is there a photographer associated with the publishing company?
So we actually commissioned local photographers within the actual countries to keep the economy localised. But one of the challenges was definitely keeping the quality of the photography consistent, and also accomplishing a consistent feel throughout the book. The main barriers were the different language barriers and also the different time locations around the world. So it would often not be a surprise for my husband John to find me messaging Australia in the middle of the night, for example.
Yes, I'm not surprised. Now, I got involved in editing a book with a whole load of European partners, and it was a challenge, 15 of them. Yeah, it was tricky.
It definitely has its challenges, but I think people are genuinely really delighted for someone to share their story in a trusted, well-respected way and in an entertaining and an accessible, informative way, such as a story cookbook. So I'm really proud of it, actually, and I love it so much. I've kept in touch with the farmers and the fishermen, and we're hoping to adapt Islands in a Common Sea into a docu-series. So we're looking for investors or people interested or producers who would like to come on board to help do that. We've been out filming, and I have self-indulgently got my own YouTube channel, and there's three 10-minute films on there showcasing the stories from the Netherlands, South Africa and India, and you can see a 1-minute trailer for that. So if anyone is interested to collaborate or get involved, please do get in touch.
But did you go to those countries to do the filming?
I went to the Netherlands, but alas, I didn't go to South Africa or India, unfortunately. But I'm collaborating with the wonderful, talented, passionate Colin Ramsay, who's the director of the film 6 Inches of Soil, which covers the lives of the three regenerative farmers in the UK. So it's just wonderful to have and enjoy that collaboration and that opportunity to get the stories out there from Islands in a Common Sea.
Well, that's absolutely brilliant. And just remind me about the other books that you've produced, if you can just run through those with me.
Yeah, so there are For the Love of the Land, which celebrates the British farmers and their food, and also For the Love of the Sea, which is a similar story cookbook but celebrates the British fishing communities. And then very, very imaginatively entitled sequels, For the Love of the Land 2 and For the Love of the Sea 2. And there's over 200 recipes in there, all a mixture of meat, fish, dairy, vegetarian, vegan substitutions. And in a similar format, they are story cookbooks. So I invited farmers and fishermen from all over the UK to contribute a recipe and words to accompany that recipe, to try and sort of give a voice and an idea of all the hard graft and the passion and the dedication that goes into helping to put food on our tables.
Mm. That's fantastic. And of course, as the fact that you are from a farming family yourself, you really do understand what the trials, tribulations and pleasures are of farming, of course.
Yeah, so I don't actually have a background in food farming or fishing until I married my farming husband, who lives in South Cambridgeshire, about 11 years ago. And so it's been a very steep learning curve becoming a farmer's wife. But I feel like this is my calling in life, to really bang the drum for farmers and fishermen, because I think in mass media there is so much misinformation and it's quite difficult to cut through that negative narrative about food production. So I do all I can with my writing and my books and producing and campaigning to really try and reach and bridge the gap between producer and consumer and the urban and rural divide.
So what are the other things that you're involved in at the moment, other than promoting your book, of course?
So I'm the co-founder of #Fish24, which was a social media, 24-hour social media celebration of the British fishing and seafood industry, which happened in May. That was the first time it happened where, for 24 hours, everybody involved in the fishing community, consumers, fishmongers, fishermen, anybody and everybody, got involved to share their story loud and proud about what they do, how they do it and why. And that was in collaboration with Mike Warner and also the Fishing News publication. And the date for next year, I can exclusively tell you, it will be on the Thursday, the 14th of May, 2026.
Oh, well, that's lovely to have all these things to look forward to. Well, we will watch this space, Jenny, to find out what you're going to be up to next.
Thank you very much indeed.
On to wine news now. At the Wine Rooms in Hills Road on the 23rd of July, there's a tasting called the Three Rivers of France, and that has wines from the Loire, the Rhone and the Garonne. On the 30th July, at the same venue, there's a wine and cheese tasting in which you'll be guided through the art of pairing wine with cheese and how to create the perfect match. And looking ahead, the 16th of September, there's Chateau Zara tasting with wines from Lebanon's Bekaa Valley, and that's with Michael Karam.
Cambridge Wine Merchants has a tasting of Spanish wines with Steve Hovington of the Cambridge Wine Academy at the Cherry Hinton Road branch, and that's for £35.
King Street Cellars is starting a book and wine club. It begins on the 7th of August with Hotel Du Lac by Anita Bruckner, along with three wines that will match the mood. Great idea, I think. Mm. Tickets are available from the King Street Cellar website.
And continuing with the wine theme, we're going to head over now to Grape Britannia on Chesterton Road. They specialise in English and Welsh wines. So we're into another heatwave, our third, I think. We've had the warmest June since 1976, the driest spring in 132 years. The first hosepipe ban of the year came into force yesterday in Yorkshire. And Cambridge Water emailed me to say that customer demand has reached an average of 98 million litres of water per day. And that's only going to increase as the weather persists. So we're all going to hell. Apart from wine specialist Matt Hodgson. For him, the scorching summer weather is perfect for mad dogs and English wines.
Yeah, indeed. The vines really do love the sunshine. And as long as they're established, they send their roots down very deep. They will find water. They'll find water down there in the ground. So even in 2022, when we had the 40 degrees temperatures, when we had sustained periods without rain, we had wildfires raging outside London, the vines coped. And in fact, again, they thrived. It's only just the newly planted ones you have to be careful of. So if you're a vineyard manager who's planted some vines, you may need to give them a little bit of watering and TLC. But other than that, no, the vines in the UK will survive whatever the sun can throw at them.
Oh, you mad impetuous think it's champagne.
Not exactly. Sparkling Muscatel, one of the finest wines of Idaho.
Well, you may serve us now, please.
Oh, may I?
We get people into the shop, they're, you know, ready for an ice cold beverage and something like a glass of English sparkling wine nicely chilled. Mm. Definitely hits the spot. It's kind of interesting because it's quite a long-term process, winemaking, so the weather now and the impact it has on the vines and the grapes won't really come to bottle for a little while. It's definitely the case that 20, 30 years ago, we were really quite marginal in England in terms of the temperatures for getting the grapes to the level you'd really want for quality sparkling wine and still wine. And so what we've seen over the last 20, and particularly maybe 10 years, is this fantastic increase in the quality of the grapes that are coming off the vines. I always like to say, just as a little addendum to that, that there is another piece to it as well. It's not just about the climate and the warmer temperatures. The English wine industry has kind of been maturing in its winemaking capacity and quality as well. You know, as the winemakers get more vintages under their belt, there's definitely an aspect to that in terms of the improvement there as well. But yeah, 100% the increased warmth and sunshine has been really, really important to the development of the industry. We started Grape Britannia in 2019 off the back of the 2018 vintage, which at the time was absolutely the hottest, warmest year, really, certainly the summer, on record. But the vines love it. Vines are wonderful sunbathers. They almost can't get too much sunshine. And to make quality wines, particularly still wines, actually, that's really, really important. It's something that people don't necessarily know, that for sparkling wines, actually, they're a little bit more tolerant of not getting high levels of sunshine. But for a still wine, and English still wines are the fastest growing segment of the English wine market, getting that warmth, getting that temperature coming along is super important. So years like 2018, 2022, and fingers crossed, 2025, will really kind of be able to showcase stunning quality of English still wines from those vintages. But not to say that the sparkling wines won't be great as well. But yeah, definitely something for the still wine aficionados as well.
Do you get to visit many UK vineyards?
Absolutely. You know, that's one of the great things about being a specialist in English and Welsh wines, that these vineyards are in some cases almost literally on the doorstep. There are actually over 1,000 vineyards in the UK now, and that number's growing all the time. So you really don't have to travel too far these days to find a vineyard on your doorstep. So it's one of my favourite parts of the job. The industry is still relatively young on a kind of international scale, and there's so much enthusiasm, and it's infectious. I really do enjoy meeting the people, hearing their stories, and of course, trying the wines. But again, it's actually something that individuals can do increasingly. The English wine industry is relatively well set up for vino tourism, if I can call it that. So the majority of the English and Welsh vineyards will do tours, probably see inside the winery, and absolutely definitely sample their delicious wines. It can make a great day out. And in some areas where there is now a really high density of vineyards, entrepreneurial people have put together little minibus tours and will take you around 3 or 4 vineyards in a day. Yeah, in a summer like this, with this glorious weather, what better way to spend a weekend than going around a few vineyards in the sunshine? One of the vineyards that we've worked with for a few years now was actually the first Welsh vineyard ever to win a gold medal at the Decanter World Wine Awards, is located near Abergavenny in southeast Wales. And as you say, you might not think that that's going to be the most promising place in the world to establish a vineyard. But Robin Nicola Merchant, who set up White Castle Vineyard, had a little farmhouse in a little side valley, and they noticed all the clouds and the weather systems would float down the main valley and dump their rain there, whilst their little side valley kind of remained gloriously in sunshine most of the time. And so on their sort of picturesque south-facing slope, it just accumulates golden rays. And they've got this really sort of heat-absorbing soil there. It's red sandstone. So during the day, it picks up all the warmth from the sun and then slowly kind of releases it through night. So it just keeps the place warm enough. So you've got this lovely combination of warmth and dryness, which is what we need for basically getting quality grapes in this climate. It's helped by their passion and dedication and long hours in the vineyard as well. But yes, the microclimate there is really important.
And their ability to spot that as well.
Yes, that's exactly right. It does take an eye for it. And there's some features, you know, that make sense. You want a south-facing slope because that's going to maximise the sunshine hours. You know, certain types of soil are likely to be better than others. But there are other things that maybe you wouldn't know, that maybe proximity to a body of water, like a river or a lake, can be really beneficial because it helps keep frost away. Frost can be terrible for English vineyard owners. In fact, in some ways, it's the worst risk to them, because if the vines have got going, there's a late frost, they can lose 50, 70% of their crop for the year. But yes, fortunately, this year, 2025, we're talking about the weather, it's been glorious pretty much the whole way through. So I think that viticulturalists are always a little bit superstitious, very nervous of calling a vintage too early. And, you know, in England with our variable weather, that's probably more true than in many places around the world. So we have had a fantastic 2025 so far, but we've still got months to go before those grapes will be harvested off the vines. So I think people are just saying it's been pretty good so far, and keeping their fingers crossed that this continues.
And may we have straws, please?
Yes. I expected that.
Thank you. That'll be all for now.
Oh. Is there anyone that you'd like to champion just for the radio? Say, if someone's coming along to Chesterton Road in Great Britannia, you might want to try this.
I really couldn't look further than our house sparkling wine here in the bar. It's an absolute gem. It's from Hazel End Vineyard in Hertfordshire. It's an English sparkling wine that is delightfully fresh, fruity and floral. And it's a 10-year-old vintage sparkling as well, for a price that is absolutely a steal. So I would definitely say get down here and get some of that in your glass.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you, Matt.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge Radio. Yeah, that was Matt Hodgson of Great Britannia on 34 Chesterton Road. And just to repeat, if you fancy popping in, he recommends his house sparkling from Hazel End Vineyard in Hertfordshire, a 10-year-old vintage that's fresh, fruity and floral. Great Britannia have won Best Specialist Retailer for England and Wales at the annual Decanter Awards, beating out Waitrose that particular year. And if you live in Cambridge, they can deliver your wine to you via their eco-friendly box bike. And there's the music signalling time for news from social media.
Yes, and just a reminder that Flavour is on social media. We use Instagram and we are at FlavourCam. Garden House by the river in Cambridge has sent a message saying they have coming up an exclusive gin tasting experience hosted by William Lowe, master distiller, master of wine as well, and co-founder of Cambridge Distillery. And it takes place on the 7th of August. There's tastings at 5 p.m. and at 6:30 p.m. That's Garden House. A message from AD from Sweet Pea Market Garden. She won't be at the Cambridge Station Little Market area. Well, she wasn't there yesterday. She won't be there next Friday. And that's because there's gas works going on by the station. But she will be back on the 25th of July. And just a reminder, we've just spoken to Matt, or Matt has just spoken to Matt from Great Britannia. A reminder that on the 23rd of July, Great Britannia has a wine and crisp match, matching evening. That's just such a good idea. That's £25. It says, if you've ever wondered what wine to drink with what packet of crisps, then that's an evening for you. And also at Great Britannia, this is looking ahead on the 10th of September, exploring exotic grape varieties. North Stowe Tap and Social tonight, that's the 12th of July, from 5 till 8, Steak and Honour are there. You'll need to pre-order via North Stowe Foodies website. OK, so that's just a quick look at what's coming up on social media at the moment. And let's have a little look, we've got a few minutes, at what's in the current edition of Feast from The Guardian. Grace Dent has been trying a restaurant, it's actually in Bristol, in a disused or repurposed shipping container. And she says, the French, at least at one stage in their culinary history, oh, the restaurant's called Lapin, which, if you don't speak French, is French for rabbit. The French, at least at one stage in culinary history, would not have balked at eating the entire cast of Watership Down in a robust Dijon sauce. The British, on the other hand, have always been rather less keen. So it was surprising to hear reports that Le Pain, a new French restaurant in Bristol, had been struggling to keep bunnies on its classic single-sheet menu due to supply reasons, apparently because its game dealer couldn't shoot them quickly enough to meet Le Pain's demand. Instead, its diners had to settle for confit duck, coarse sausage and deep-fried pig's head.
Good God.
You wonder how big the fire is. Le Pain is a peculiar, meta, slightly earnest, definitely delicious French restaurant that you would never ever find in France, not least because no one in France would be seen dead eating in an old metal box. Anyway, that's in Bristol anyway. So Rachel Roddy has a recipe for courgette risotto. Tom Hunt has an interesting idea for vegetable scraps in which you can make a cake with the coconut icing. And there's also from Anna Beryl some ideas for making stir-fry sauces which aren't sweet, dense and cloying. Tom Hunt, who we've just mentioned, with his vegetable scraps, has reviewed eggs, and most eggs get 4 stars. The best overall, St. Hugh's rich yolk free-range eggs from Ocado. Benjamin, I never know how to pronounce Benjamina's last name, Ibuhi, has passion fruit Jaffa cakes. Recipe for passion juice, fresh, which look lovely, don't they?
They look fantastic. Nice and thick as well. Look at the thickness
and chocolate,
of those.
Just very chocolatey as yeah. Well. Yeah, they look fantastic. So there's something good. What else is a Felicity Cloak, the perfect bun char, a northern Vietnamese speciality of juicy char-grilled pork. There's something else, potato salad. This is Ravinda Bogal, potato chat salad with yogurt. Yeah, I think that's probably about it. Oh, one more. Cashew rice bowls with tofu, broccoli and kimchi. All sorts of good things. Yum.
Passion fruit Jaffa cakes for me this week, I think.
I think. Yeah. Invite me round and I'll help you out with eating them.
Onto our job section now, and we begin with Modigliani. They are looking for people to work as shop assistants and kitchen assistants. You'll need to work from Monday to Sunday on a rotating schedule. Just send your CV and a covering letter to modigliani@themodiglianigroup.org or pop in to the Mill Road shop with them.
And there's a full-time job supporting the coffee shop at North Stowe Tap and Social. Send your CV to info@northstowetapandsocial. Or pop in and have a chat with them.
All of which brings us to the end of today's programme. And don't forget that we are here on alternate Saturdays at 12 noon, repeated on Mondays at 2 p.m, and we're also available as a podcast from all the usual places.
We're also sometimes repeated on Sunday, Matt.
Yeah, it's happening more and more these days.
What time on Sunday, or is it different times?
I think it's about 2 p.m.
2 o'clock, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, okay.
And coming up next on Cambridge Radio is Strummers and Dreamers with Les Ray.
We will be back on the 26th of July with lots more food and drink, news, jobs and features. Until then,
goodbye.